Jackson as they were heard on the BBC Saturday Club on June 17th, 1967.
The Salon Piano Series continues its 10th anniversary season with a concert by Shai Wassner on Sunday, April 21st at 4 p.m. at Farley's House of Pianos. Wassner is committed to a broad range of innovative programming and recognized for exceptional insight in his playing and performance. His concert program will include works by Purcell, Chopin, Beethoven, Harbison, and Schumann. More information is at salonpianoseries.org. The Salon Piano Series continues its 10th anniversary season with a concert by Shai Wassner on Sunday, April 21st, 4 p.m. at Farley's House of Pianos, 6522 Siebold Road in Madison. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
The third Friday of the month, a little past 11, time for another installment of Fiction Jones with part 13 of Mary Shelley's 1818 novel, Frankenstein. But first, a little trip down those train tracks. Yes, those train tracks going somewhere in Germany. Let's listen.
You will now listen to my voice. My voice will help you and guide you still deeper into Europa. Every time you hear my voice, with every word and every number, you will enter a still deeper layer, open, relaxed, and receptive. I shall now count from 1 to 10. On the count of 10, you will be in Europa. I say 1. And as you focus your attention entirely on my voice, you will slowly begin to relax. Two, your hands and your fingers are getting warmer and heavier. Three, the warmth is spreading through your arms, to your shoulders and your neck. Four, your feet and your legs get heavier. Five, the warmth is spreading to the whole of your body. On six, I want you to go deeper. I say six, and the whole of your relaxed body is slowly beginning to sink. Seven, you go deeper and deeper and deeper. Eight, on every breath you take, you go deeper. Nine, you are floating. On the mental count of 10, you will be in Europa. Be there at 10. I say 10. You are listening to the noise of rain beating against a large metal drum. Go closer. There's a fence, and you have to stop. You are walking across the rail yard, and you've been traveling by train from Bremerhaven, and before that, on a ship from New York. You are in Germany. The year is 1945.
The year is 1818, and we're actually in Scotland. Victor Frankenstein has ended up there to pursue his research. We're about two-thirds of the way through the book. Dr. Frankenstein, of course, has brought a collection of dead body parts, organs, and nerves to ungainly life. The creature he's made has broken loose into the world, shunned, abused everywhere. Finally, driven to murder. First Victor's young brother, William, and now his best friend, Clerval. Victor has been arrested as a suspect. The creature was desperate for a female companion. Victor had promised him to make it, but now he refuses. He's terrified that it will just mean more chaos and evil unleashed on the world. The creature is inconsolable and mad as hell. Part 13 of Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, coming up next on Fiction Jones. I entered a dark room where the corpse lay and was led up to the coffin. How can I describe my sensations on beholding it? I feel yet parched with horror and agony. Anything that faintly reminds me of this anguish of recognition. The trial, the presence of the magistrate and witnesses passed like a dream from my memory when I saw the lifeless form of Henry Clerval stretched before me. I gasped for breath, and throwing myself on the body, I exclaimed, "Have my murderous machinations deprived you also, my dearest Henry, of life? Two I have already destroyed. Other victims await their destiny. But you, Clerval, my friend, my benefactor." The human frame could no longer support the agonizing suffering that I endured, and I was carried out of the room in strong convulsions. A fever succeeded to this. I lay for 2 months on the point of death. My ravings, as I afterwards heard, were frightful. I called myself the murderer of William, of Justine, of Clerval. Sometimes I entreated my attendants to assist me in the destruction of the fiend by whom I was tormented. And at others I felt the fingers of the monster already grasping my neck and screamed aloud with agony and terror. Fortunately, as I spoke my native language, Mr. Kirwan alone understood me. But my gestures and bitter cries were sufficient to affright the other witnesses. Why didn't I die? More miserable than man ever was before, why did I not sink into forgetfulness and rest? Death snatches away many blooming children, the only hopes of their doting parents. How many brides, how many youthful lovers have been one day in the bloom of health and hope, and the next a prey for worms and decay of the tomb? Of what materials was I made that I could thus resist so many shocks, which, like the turning of the wheel, continually renewed the torture? But I was doomed to live, and in 2 months found myself as awakening from a dream in a prison, stretched on a wretched bed, surrounded by gaolers, turnkeys, bolts, and all the miserable apparatus of a dungeon. It was morning, I remember, when I thus awoke to understanding. I had forgotten the particulars of what had happened, and only felt as if some great misfortune had suddenly overwhelmed me. But when I looked around, I saw the barred windows and the squalidness of the room in which I was all flashed across my memory, and I groaned bitterly. The sound disturbed an old woman who was sleeping in a chair beside me. She was a hired nurse, the wife of one of the turnkeys, and her countenance expressed all those bad qualities which often characterize that class. The lines of her face were hard and rude, and like that of persons accustomed to see without sympathizing in sights of misery. Her tone expressed her entire indifference. She addressed me in English, and the voice struck me as one that I had heard during my sufferings. "Are you better now, sir?" said she. I replied in the same language with a feeble voice, "I believe I am. But if it be all true, if indeed I did not dream, I'm sorry that I'm still alive to feel this misery and horror." I replied, or she replied, "Well, for that matter, if you mean about the gentleman you murdered, I believe that it were better for you if you were dead, for I fancy it will go hard with you, but you will be hung when the next session comes on. However, that's none of my business. I am sent to nurse you and get you well. I do my duty with a safe conscience. If it were well if everybody did the same. I turned with loathing from the woman who could utter so unfeeling a speech to a person just saved, on the very edge of death. But I felt languid and unable to reflect on all that had passed. The whole series of my life appeared to me as a dream. I sometimes doubted if indeed it were all true, for it never presented itself to my mind with the force of reality. As the images that floated before me became more distinct, I grew feverish. A darkness pressed around me. No one was near me who soothed me with the gentle voice of love. No dear hand supported me. The physician came and prescribed medicines, and the old woman prepared them for me. But utter carelessness was visible in the first, and the expression of brutality was strongly marked in the visage of the second. Who could be interested in the fate of a murderer but the hangman who would gain his fee? These were my first reflections, but I soon learned that Mr. Kirwin had shown me extreme kindness. He had caused the best room in the prison to be prepared for me. Wretched, indeed, was the best. And it was he who had provided a physician and a nurse. It's true he seldom came to see me, for although he ardently desired to relieve the sufferings of every human creature, he did not wish to be present at the agonies and the miserable ravings of a murderer. He came, therefore, sometimes to see that I was not neglected, but his visits were short and at long intervals. One day, when I was gradually recovering, I was seated in a chair, my eyes half open. My cheeks were livid like those in death. I was overcome by gloom and misery, and often reflected that I had better seek death than remain miserably pent up, only to be let loose in a world replete with wretchedness. At one time, I considered whether I should not declare myself guilty and suffer the penalty of the law, less innocent than poor Justine had been. Such were my thoughts when the door of my apartment was opened and Mr. Kirwin entered. His countenance expressed sympathy and compassion. He drew a chair close to mine and addressed me in French. "I fear that this place is very shocking to you. Can I do anything to make you more comfortable?" "I thank you, but all that you mention is nothing to me. On the whole earth there is no comfort which I am capable of receiving." "I know that the sympathy of a stranger can be but of little relief to one borne down as you by so strange a misfortune. But you will, I hope, soon quit this melancholic abode, for doubtless evidence can easily be brought to free you from the criminal charge." "That is my least concern, believe me. I am, by a course of strange events, become the most miserable of mortals. Persecuted and tortured as I am and have been, can death be any evil to me? Nothing indeed could be more unfortunate and agonizing than the strange chances that have lately occurred. You were thrown by some surprising accident on this shore, renowned for its hospitality. You were seized immediately, and you were charged with murder. The first sight that was presented to your eyes was the body of your friend, murdered in so unaccountable a manner, and placed, as it were, by some fiend across your path." As Mr. Kirwin said this, notwithstanding the agitation I endured and this retrospect of my sufferings, I also felt considerable surprise at the knowledge he seemed to possess concerning me. I suppose some astonishment was exhibited in my countenance. Mr. Kirwin hastened to say, "It was not until a day or two after your illness that I thought of examining your dress, that I might discover some trace by which I could send to your relations an account of your misfortune and illness. I found several letters, and among others, one which I discovered from its commencement to be from your father. I instantly wrote to Geneva. Nearly 2 months have elapsed since the departure of my letter, but you are ill. Even now you tremble. You are unfit for agitation of any kind. This suspense is 1,000 times worse than the most horrible event. Tell me what new scene of death has been acted, and whose murder I am now to lament. Your family is perfectly well, said Mr. Kirwin with gentleness, and someone, a friend, is come to visit you. I know not by what chain of thought the idea presented itself, but it instantly darted into my mind that the murderer had come to mock at my misery and taunt me with the death of Clerval, as a new incitement for me to comply with his hellish desires for a mate. I put my hand before my eyes. I cried out in agony, "Take him away. I can't see him. For God's sake, don't let him enter." Mr. Kirwin regarded me with a troubled countenance. He could not help regarding my exclamation as a presumption of my guilt, and said in a rather severe tone, "I should have thought, young man, that the presence of your father would have been welcome instead of inspiring such violent repugnance." "My father!" cried I, while every feature and every muscle was relaxed from anguish to pleasure. "Is my father indeed come? How kind, how very kind! But where is he? Why does he not hasten to me?" My change of manner surprised and pleased the magistrate. Perhaps he thought that my former exclamation was a momentary return of delirium, and now he instantly resumed his former benevolence. He rose and quitted the room with my nurse, and in a moment my father entered it. Nothing, at this moment, could have given me greater pleasure than the arrival of my father. I stretched out my hand to him, and I cried, Are you safe? Elizabeth? Ernest?" My father calmed me with assurances of their welfare, and endeavored, by dwelling on these subjects so interesting to my heart, to raise a desponding spirits. But he soon felt that a prison cannot be the abode of cheerfulness. "What a place is this that you inhabit, my son," said he, looking mournfully at the barred windows and wretched appearance of the room. "You travel to seek happiness, but a fatality seems to pursue you, and poor Clerval." The name of my unfortunate and murdered friend was an agitation too great to be endured in my weak state. I shed tears. "Alas, my father," replied I, "some destiny of the most horrible kind hangs over me, and I must live to fulfill it, or surely I should have died on the coffin of Henry." And you're tuned to WORT and Greg Willard with Fiction Jones and our reading of Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. Music tonight by, well, a couple of different people. BBC. Angelo Lavanino for our theme music. And Reina Thorvaldsdottir from her Dreaming CD. As I've been reading this book, just a quick aside, it's occurred to me that I'm not aware of any dramatization that sticks closely to the book, which is kind of a shame because it's an interesting plot. Of course, gothic and melodramatic by the conventions of the day, but still some very interesting twists and turns, kind of symmetry to it, as one by one, everyone closest to Victor Frankenstein ends up dead. The cost of creating this creature, setting it loose alone and bereft. Is very high. Let's get back to the book. We were not allowed to converse for any length of time, for the precarious state of my health rendered every precaution necessary that could ensure tranquility. Mr. Kerwin came in and insisted that my strength should not be exhausted by too much exertion. But the appearance of my father was to me like that of my good angel, and I gradually recovered my health. As my sickness quitted me, I was absorbed by a gloomy and black melancholy. Nothing could dissipate it. The image of Clerval was forever before me, ghastly, murdered. More than once, the agitation into which these reflections threw me made my friends dread a dangerous relapse. Alas, why did they preserve so miserable and detested a life? It was surely that I might fulfill my destiny, which is now drawing to a close. Soon, very soon, will death extinguish these throbbings and relieve me from the mighty weight of anguish that bears me to dust. And in executing the award of justice, I shall also sink to rest. And then the appearance of death was distant, although the wish was ever present in my thoughts, and I often sat for hours motionless and speechless, wishing for some mighty revolution that might bury me and my destroyer in its ruins. The season of the Assizes approached. I had already been 3 months in prison, and although I was still weak and in continual danger of relapse, I was obliged to travel nearly 100 miles to the county town where the court was held. Mr. Kerwin charged himself with every care of collecting witnesses and arranging my defense. I was spared the disgrace of appearing publicly as a criminal, as the case was not brought before the court that decides on life and death. The grand jury rejected the bill on its being proved that I was on the Orkney Islands at the hour the body of my friend was found, and a fortnight after my removal, I was liberated from prison. My father was enraptured on finding me freed from the vexations of a criminal charge, and I was again allowed to breathe the fresh atmosphere and allowed to return to my native country. I did not participate in these feelings. For me, the walls of the dungeon or a palace were alike hateful. The cup of life was poisoned forever, and although the sun shone upon me as upon the happy and gay of heart, I saw around me nothing but a dense and frightful darkness, penetrated by no light but the glimmer of two eyes that glared upon me. Sometimes they were the expressive eyes of Henry, languishing in death, the dark orbs nearly covered by the lids, and the long black lashes that fringed them. Sometimes it was the watery, clouded eyes of the monster, as I first saw them in my chamber at Ingolstadt. My father tried to awaken in me the feelings of affection. He talked of Geneva, where I should soon visit, of Elizabeth and Ernest. But these words only drew deep groans from me. Sometimes, indeed, I felt a wish for happiness and thought, with melancholy delight, of my beloved cousin, or longed with a devouring maladie du pas, to see once more the blue lake and the rapid Rhone that had been so dear to me in early childhood. But my general state of feeling was a torpor in which a prison was as welcome a residence as the divine scene in nature, and these fits were seldom interrupted but by paroxysms of anguish and despair. At these moments, I often endeavored to put an end to the existence I loathed, and it required unceasing attendance and vigilance to restrain me from committing some dreadful act of violence. I remember as I quitted the prison, I heard one of the men say, "He may be innocent of the murder, but he's certainly a bad conscience." These words struck me. A bad conscience. Yes, surely I had one. William, Justine, Clerval, they died through my infernal machinations. "And whose death," cried I, "is to finish the tragedy? My father, do not remain in this wretched country. Take me where I may forget myself and my existence and all the world." My father easily acceded to my desire, and after having taken leave of Mr. Kirwan, we hastened to Dublin. I felt as if I was relieved from a heavy weight when the Pact sailed with a fair wind from Ireland, and I had quitted for every country which had been to me the scene of so much misery. It was midnight. My father slept in the cabin, and I lay on the deck, looking at the stars, listening to the dashing of the waves. I hailed the darkness that shut Ireland from my sight, and my pulse beat with a feverish joy when I reflected that I should soon see Geneva. The past appeared to me in the light of a frightful dream. Yet the vessel in which I was, the wind that blew me from the detested shore of Ireland, and the sea which surrounded me, told me too forcibly that I was deceived by no vision, and that Clerval, my friend and the dearest companion, had fallen a victim to me and the monster of my creation. I repassed in my memory my whole life, my quiet happiness while residing with my family in Geneva, the death of my mother, and my departure for Ingolstadt. I remembered, shuddering at the mad enthusiasm that had hurried me on to the creation of my hideous enemy, and I called to mind the night during which he first lived. I was unable to pursue the train of thought. A thousand feelings pressed upon me, and I wept bitterly. Ever since my recovery from the fever, I had been in the custom of taking every night a small quantity of laudanum, for it was by means of this drug only that I was enabled to gain the necessary rest for the preservation of life. Oppressed by the recollection of my various misfortunes, I now took a double dose, and soon slept profoundly. But sleep did not afford me respite from thought and misery. My dreams presented 1,000 objects that scared me. Toward morning, I was possessed by a kind of nightmare. I felt the fiend's grasp in my neck and could not free myself from it. Groans and cries rung in my ears. My father, who was watching over me, perceiving my restlessness, awoke me and pointed to the port of Holyhead, which we were now entering.
Thank you.
Chapter 5. We had resolved not to go to London, but to cross the country to Portsmouth, and thence to embark for Havre. I preferred this plan principally because I dreaded to see again those places in which I had enjoyed a few moments of tranquillity with my beloved Clerval. I thought with horror of seeing again those persons whom we had been accustomed to visit together, and who might make inquiries concerning an event, the rare remembrance of which made me again feel the pang I endured when I gazed on his lifeless form in the inn at. As for my father, his desires and exertions were bounded to the again seeing me restored to health and peace of mind. His tenderness and attentions were unremitting. My grief and gloom was obstinate, but he would not despair. Sometimes he thought that I felt deeply the degradation of being obliged to answer a charge of murder, and he endeavored to prove to me the futility of pride. "Alas, my father," said I, "how little do you know me? Human beings, their feelings and passions would indeed be degraded if such a wretch as I felt pride. Justine, poor unhappy Justine, was as innocent as I, and she suffered the same charge. She died for it, and I'm the cause of this. I murdered her. William, Justine, Henry, they all died by my hands." My father had often during my imprisonment heard me make such assertions. When I thus accused myself, he sometimes seemed to desire an explanation, and at other times he appeared to consider it as caused by delirium, and that there would be no explanation. That during my illness some idea of this kind had presented itself to my imagination, the remembrance of which I preserved in my convalescence. I avoided explaining, and maintained a continual silence concerning the wretch that I had created. I had a feeling that I should be supposed mad, and this forever changed my tongue, when I would have given the whole world to have confided this fatal secret. Upon this occasion, my father said with an expression of unbounded wonder, "What do you mean, Victor? Are you mad? My dear son, I entreat you never to make such an assertion again." "I'm not mad," I cried energetically. "The sun and the heavens, who have viewed my operations, can bear witness of my truth. I'm the assassination of those innocent victims. They died by my machinations. 1,000 times would I have shed my own blood, drop by drop, to have saved their lives. But I could not, my father. Indeed, I could not sacrifice the whole human race." The conclusion of this speech convinced my father that my ideas were deranged, and he instantly changed the subject of our conversation and endeavored to alter the course of my thoughts. He wished as much as possible to obliterate the memory of the scenes that had taken place in Ireland, and never alluded to them or suffered me to speak of my misfortunes. As time passed away, I became more calm. Misery had her dwelling in my heart, but I no longer talked in the same incoherent manner of my own crimes. Sufficient for me was the consciousness of them. By the utmost self-violence, I curbed the imperious voice of wretchedness, which sometimes desired to declare itself to the whole world. And my manners were calmer and more composed than they had ever been since my journeys to the sea of ice. We arrived at Havre on the 8th of May, and instantly proceeded to Paris, where my father had some business which detained us a few weeks. In this city I received the following letter from Elizabeth. "My dearest friend, it gave me the greatest pleasure to receive a letter from my uncle dated at Paris. You are no longer at a formidable distance, and I may hope to see you in less than a fortnight. My poor cousin, how much you must have suffered. I expect to see you looking even more ill than when you quitted Geneva. This winter has been passed most miserably, tortured as I have been by anxious suspense. Yet I hope to see peace in your countenance, and to find that your heart is not totally devoid of comfort and tranquility. Yet I fear that the same feelings now exist that made you so miserable a year ago, even periods perhaps augmented by time. I would not disturb you at this period when so many misfortunes weigh upon you. But a conversation that I had with my uncle previous to his departure renders some explanation necessary before we meet. Explanation, you may possibly say. What can Elizabeth have to explain? Well, if you really say this, my questions are answered, and I have no more to do than to sign myself your affectionate cousin. But you are distant from me, and it is possible that you may dread, yet be pleased with this explanation, and in a probability of this being the case, I dare not any longer postpone writing what, during your absence, I have often wished to express to you, but have never had the courage to begin. You will know, Victor, that our union had been the favorite plan of your parents ever since our infancy. We were told this when young, and taught to look forward to it as an event that would certainly take place. We were affectionate playfellows during childhood, and I believe dear and valued friends to one another as we grew older. But as brother and sister often entertain a lively affection towards each other without desiring a more intimate union, may not such also be our case? Tell me, dearest Victor, answer me, I conjure you, by our mutual happiness with simple truth, do you not love another? You have traveled, you have spent several years of your life at Ingolstadt, and I confess to you, my friend, that when I saw you last autumn so unhappy, flying to solitude from the society of every creature, I could not help supposing that you might regret our connection, and believe yourself bound in honor to fulfill the wishes of your parents, although they oppose themselves to your inclinations. But this is a false reasoning. I confess to you, my cousin, that I love you, and that in my airy dreams of futurity, you have been my constant friend and companion. But it is your happiness I desire, as well as my own, when I declare to you that our marriage would render me eternally miserable unless it were the dictate of your own free will. Even now, I weep to think that, borne down as you are by the cruelest misfortunes, you may stifle by the word honor all hope of yourself. I, who have so interested an affection for you, may increase your miseries tenfold by being an obstacle to your wishes. Victor, be assured that your cousin and playmate has too sincere a love for you not to be made miserable by this supposition. Be happy, my friend, and if you obey me in this one request, remain satisfied that nothing on earth will have the power to interrupt my tranquility. Do not let this letter disturb you. Do not answer it tomorrow, or next day, or even until you come, if it will give you pain. My uncle will send me news of your health, and if I see you but smile on your lips when we meet, occasioned by this or any other exertion of mine, I shall need no other happiness. Elizabeth Lavenna, Geneva, May 1817. This letter revived in my memory what I had long forgotten, the threat of the fiend, I will be with you on your wedding night. Such was my sentence, and on that night would the daemon employ every art to destroy me and tear me from the glimpse of happiness which promised partly to console my sufferings. On that night he had determined to consummate his crimes by my death. Well, be it so. A deadly struggle would then assuredly take place, in which, if he was victorious, I should be at peace, and his power over me be at my end. If he were vanquished, I should be a free man. Alas, what freedom! Such as the peasant enjoys when his family has been massacred before his eyes, his cottage burnt, his lands laid waste, and he's turned adrift, homeless, penniless, alone, but free. Such would be my liberty, except that in my Elizabeth I possessed a treasure, alas, balanced by those horrors of remorse and guilt which would pursue me until death. Sweet, beloved Elizabeth, I read and reread her letter, and some softened feeling stole into my heart and dared to whisper paradisical dreams of love and joy. But the apple was already eaten, and the angel's arm bared to drive me from all hope. Yet I would die to make her happy. If the monster executed his threat, death was inevitable. Yet again I considered whether my marriage would hasten my fate. My destruction might indeed arrive a few months sooner, but if my torturer should suspect that I postponed it, influenced by his menaces, he would surely find another, and perhaps more dreadful means of revenge. He had vowed to be with me on my wedding night, yet he did not consider the threat as binding him to peace in the meantime. For, as if he showed me he was not yet satisfied with blood, he had murdered Clerval immediately after the enunciation of his threats. I resolved, therefore, that if my immediate union with my cousin would conduct either to her or my father's happiness, my adversary's designs against my life should not retard it a single hour. In this state of mind I wrote to Elizabeth. My letter was calm and affectionate. "I fear, my beloved girl," I said, "little happiness remains for us on earth. Yet all that I may one day enjoy is concentrated in you. Chase away your idle fears. To you alone do I consecrate my life and my endeavors for contentment. I have one secret, Elizabeth, a dreadful one. When revealed to you, it will chill your frame with horror, and then, far from being surprised at my misery, you will only wonder that I survive what I have endured. I'll confide this tale of misery and terror to you the day after our marriage shall take place. For, my sweet cousin, there must be perfect confidence between us. But until then, I conjure you, do not mention or allude to it. This I most earnestly entreat, and I know you will comply." In about a week after the arrival of Elizabeth's letter, we returned to Geneva. My cousin welcomed me with a warm affection, yet tears were in her eyes as she beheld my emaciated frame and feverish cheeks. I saw a change in her also. She was thinner and had lost much of that heavenly vivacity that had before charmed me. But her gentleness and soft looks of compassion made her a more fit companion for one blasted and miserable as I was. The tranquility which I now enjoyed did not endure. Memory brought madness with it, and when I thought on about what had passed, a real insanity possessed me. Sometimes I was furious and burnt with rage, sometimes low and despondent. I neither spoke or looked, but sat motionless, bewildered by the multitude of miseries that overcame me. Elizabeth alone had the power to draw me from these fits. Her gentle voice would soothe me and calm me, and she wept with me and for me. When reason returned, she would remonstrate and endeavor to inspire me with resignation. The agonies of remorse and poisoned that the luxury there is otherwise found in indulging the excess of grief was abundant. Soon after my arrival, my father spoke of my immediate marriage with my cousin. I remained silent. Have you then some other attachment? No, none on earth. I love Elizabeth. I look forward to our union with delight. Let the day, therefore, be fixed, and on it I will concentrate myself, in life or death, to the happiness of my cousin. And we're coming up on the midnight hour. That was part 13 of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I hope you can join me again next Friday at 11 p.m. for part 14 of the book. We're probably about 3 or 4 nights of reading away from finishing Frankenstein. And around this time, I start casting around for the next book. One of the priorities for this show is reading books that allow copyright freedom, that are public domain, 1923. And there, I have a couple of things in mind that were published before that date. But if you have books that you would like to hear on Fiction Jones, I'd be very interested to hear about your preferences. You can leave messages for me here at the station. My name is Greg Willard, and the show is Fiction Jones. So drop me a line if you have ideas about books you would like to hear. Coming up next is XL290 with Rick and the XL290 Music Hour. So stay tuned for that and all the other great programming here on your listener-sponsored WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Have a great week.
XL290 Live Music Radio Hour on WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Hey! What are you trying to do? You ruined my record, man! I just bought it!
Did you realize this year's Record Store Day is April 20th, also known as 420? We here at WORT are certainly aware, and as a matter of fact, we're throwing a party at the Crystal Corner Bar with two great local bands, Iftikhar and the Earthlings, supplemented by sets from WORT DJs, Julia McAnley from Her Infinite Variety, Brian Hirsch from Green Morning Radio, and Newphone Rick of XL290 Live Music Radio Hour. So we'll see you at the Crystal Corner, Saturday, April 20th, for our Record Store Day and 420 celebration with Iftikhar, the Earthlings, and WORT DJs.
True Endeavors presents Suzanne Vega, Old Songs, New Songs, and Other Songs Tour at the Barrymore on Tuesday, April 23rd. Widely regarded as one of the foremost songwriters of her generation, Suzanne Vega emerged as a leading figure of the folk revival of the early 1980s. Since the release of her self-titled, critically acclaimed 1985 debut album, she has been known for performances that convey deep emotion, and on this current tour, she is reaching into her catalog to play hits and cover songs by Lou Reed, Duncan Sheik, and others. True Endeavors presents Suzanne Vega Old Songs, New Songs, and Other Songs Tour at the Barrymore on Tuesday, April 23rd at 7:30 p.m. More information